Buongiorno, sono Juan Carlos De Martin, docente a quel Politecnico, il Politecnico di Torino, che organizza Biennale Tecnologia insieme ad altri numerosissimi partner, più di 50, e sono anche il curatore di Biennale Tecnologia insieme all'amico e collega Luca De Biase, ma sono qui a introdurre un incontro. Non soltanto in funzione del mio ruolo, come dire, istituzionale, ma sono particolarmente felice di essere qui perché il tema mi sta a cuore e perché i due relatori che sto per presentarvi mi stanno particolarmente a cuore. Il tema è il rapporto tra tecnologia e politica, in senso lato. La tecnologia viene troppo spesso vista come un qualcosa di, in qualche modo, per alcuni neutro e comunque di lontano dal mondo della politica, invece è intrinsecamente una questione tecnologica. E i due relatori che adesso vi presento sono anni che stanno studiando esattamente questo tipo di intersezione, cioè la riflessione sulla tecnologia e sul rapporto con la politica, con anche un'attenzione specifica al tema del rapporto tra blocchi e quindi al tema della geopolitica della tecnologia. Ma non voglio prendere troppo tempo ai nostri relatori, che sono gli ospiti principali. Tra l'altro, vi anticipo che verso le 15:30 dovrò purtroppo, ahimè, lasciare questa conversazione che si preannuncia straordinariamente interessante a causa di un altro impegno legato a Biennale. Quindi scusatemi fin d'ora, ma è appunto a maggior ragione non perdiamo tempo. E vado a presentarvi i nostri due ospiti, che sono Alessandro Aresu e Evgeny Morozov, che ecco vedete inquadrati. Benvenuti a Biennale Tecnologia. Mi dispiace molto non potervi dare il benvenuto di persona a Torino, come invece abbiamo fatto l'anno scorso per il Festival della Tecnologia, ma confidiamo che per la prossima edizione del 2022 ci faremo con gli interessi per questa esperienza disincarnata e virtuale. E, alcune parole di presentazione, anche se sono due nomi noti, parto semplicemente dall'ordine che vedo sullo schermo. Quindi, per primo, Evgeny Morozov, uno studioso che ormai da molti anni ci accompagna nelle riflessioni sul mondo del digitale, uno dei primi, oggettivamente uno dei primi ad avere sollevato tutta una serie di osservazioni critiche relativamente alla tecnologia digitale in un'epoca in cui dominava un entusiasmo assolutamente acritico e con dei connotati francamente irrazionali. Lui è stato il primo in qualche modo a cominciare a sgonfiare quella bolla, almeno dal punto di vista intellettuale, e quindi nel fare questo ha acquisito giustamente una grande notorietà a livello internazionale e poi ha continuato in quel solco, arricchendo e approfondendo le sue riflessioni e diventando oggettivamente uno dei punti di riferimento a livello mondiale per la riflessione sulla tecnologia digitale e potremmo dire a questo punto sulla tecnologia tout court. E quindi benvenuto Evgeny, bentornato qua a Torino virtualmente e comunque benvenuto alla prima edizione di Biennale. E, Alessandro Aresu. Alessandro, con Alessandro ci siamo confrontati ormai molte volte, ci incontrammo quasi 10 anni fa a Milano in un contesto differente, ma da allora la conversazione con Alessandro è diventata sempre più fitta, gli scambi, gli inviti reciproci che c'entrano sempre, girano sempre intorno appunto al tema di tecnologia e politica. E di recente l'opportunità di interagire con Alessandro è stata un libro importante che ho avuto il piacere di discutere con lui e tra l'altro di discutere anche in altre sedi, anche senza di lui, che è un libro in particolare concentrato su Stati Uniti e Cina e sul loro rapporto progressivamente sempre più competitivo, se non addirittura conflittuale, però appunto incentrato sul ruolo della tecnologia. E quindi sul capitalismo politico e che ruolo gioca la tecnologia in quel contesto, con due sistemi molto diversi tra loro, ma uniti da alcuni punti di contatto. Quindi due persone che stimo enormemente e sono molto lieto che avranno l'opportunità di conversare. A questo punto taccio e passo la parola a voi. Non so se Alessandro e Evgeny come vi siete organizzati. Prego.
Io ho solo una domanda, ma questo dialogo sarebbe in italiano e non in inglese? Perché prima.
No, tu puoi parlare, vieni tu puoi parlare in inglese come convenuto, parla pure
Io
in
sono
inglese.
pronto in inglese, Juan Carlos, quindi direi che facciamo in
Perfetto,
inglese.
benissimo,
Ok,
prego.
So we'll do it in English. So why don't you start maybe, Alessandro, with a little bit, maybe a short summary of the book you've published recently, because I think it might provide, actually I have the book here. It might provide, I think, a nice entry into the discussion, because, you know, my book that has been in the works for 6 or 7 years now, it's still not out. So let's start with yours, and then maybe I will share some thoughts.
I'm glad to be with you here in Turin, virtually, unfortunately. So my book and my research were focused on the fact that there is a key relationship between sovereignty, power, and technology that has to do mainly with national security, which is both a mysterious but a key concept for geopolitical powers. So what we are experiencing is that national security is widening its grasp. We should bear in mind that national security is not a new phenomenon, as well as national security in technology. It has always been there with us, such in programs to collect stuff, up to collect it all by security agency, but in the British Empire, in its use of telecommunications, for instance, in the management of submarine cables, but in all system of intelligence and the interplay between intelligence and technology, national security is involved, of course. The digital age and digital technology makes it more widespread, I think, with increasing possibilities and dangers, as well as the US-China conflict makes it more visible, because two powers compete for primacy in technology, but they compete also for other countries' markets and other countries' allegiance on the basis of security. So this process is certainly more visible, even at the surface, but the relationship between geopolitics and technology, it is fair to say, has always been with us. And nowadays, I think the exercise of power by a national community is increasingly difficult without having technology companies, digital companies. And if you don't have those companies, you tend to become a less relevant player. In Italy, this should ring a bell for us, I think. Another issue, which is also in the book, but useful for our conversation, I think, has to do with state market relations, or to be clearer, what we mean by markets in technology. For instance, if we take some sectors, let's take space. Space is so much embedded with military activities, but also with public funds, that we should talk about it frankly, of course, but admitting that there is no simple market on this. A space agency, for instance, can pay launches for a rocket company in order to make it more competitive with international clients, but it's actually subsidizing it, of course. There is no market for semiconductors, for instance. Governments do pay and subsidize semiconductor companies. They call it grants. This happens in the United States. Currently, there's bipartisan support to try and give money to semiconductor companies. But also, it happens in South Korea and, of course, in the People's Republics of China. We have Chinese plans with staggering sums for people who want to start companies producing chips. There are also other ways in which we can say that there are no simple markets in technology. We can take cloud computing, for instance, where we have dominant players, but no simple way for others to participate in those markets. So those players can claim to be innovative, but there is also always a trade-off between what they say is innovation and simple market dominance. So this awareness of what we mean by markets in those sectors could and should be, I think, part of the analysis of the alternatives. So, mm-hmm. So in my view, when we talk about alternatives, the role of government is always relevant. I mean, it's always important. I think if we mm-hmm. if we're going to use technology as a tool for inclusion. So let's take digital infrastructure, for instance. There is no simple blueprint or one size fits it all for digital infrastructure. If we take different countries, for instance, in countries such as Italy, we do not have people living mainly in urban areas. So it becomes particularly relevant to provide digital infrastructure to those people. Another issue is trying to avoid a kind of reductionism in education, in education related to technology, where coding is not the only thing we need. And ethics should be a matter of debate by citizens, shouldn't be just outsourced to companies or to some companies' board. But if we want to empower government, this has to do also with bureaucracy, which I think is an important issue at all levels. So you know the famous sentence from Shakespeare, the first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers. So the sentence has been debated. Shakespeare was probably being ironic. And personally, I don't want to kill anybody. But we can adapt this formula in a formula that might sound like the first thing we do, let's skip all the consultants. So let's get rid of consultants. Because in technology, but also in other functions of the government, we have experienced an increasing process of outsourcing functions, which in my way have to be played by the government, by the governmental bureaucracy to consultants. So making the government able to do things on its own, it's also a part of building alternatives, as it is the empowerment of political parties, which in a democracy have an important role to advance the awareness and the use of technology as a part of public speech. So that's mm-hmm. Something that I wanted to start with. So please, Evgeny, sure. And we mm-hmm. can go on and then involve also the public.
Sure. Well, let me maybe react to a few of the things you said, because you said, I think, more than a couple of quite ambitious things. I'm not sure we'll fit all of them in an hour. So let me see how many of them I can react to, and hopefully that will provide some food for dialogue. So if I heard you correctly, and based on what I've read from your book, so there is, what you're saying is that there is a way to tell a very different story, which would differ from the conventional story about how we got to, you know, capitalist modernization, if you will, where the competition in the sphere of technology would have a much more pronounced role than the role typically attributed to it by economic historians, but also by historians of capitalism, right? So if you look at kind of conventional Marxist accounts of intercapitalist competition, right, you end up with a relatively conventional story of countries improving their techniques of production, production, innovating, and essentially cutting costs and catching up with each other becomes almost very focused on some key industry, like the automobile industry for the story of European and Asian development since, 1950s, right? Of them catching up with the US, partially with the American help. What you're saying is that this is a very one-sided view and that there are other forms of technological competition, some of them having to do with technologies of communication, espionage, surveillance, I guess, which make part of the national security apparatus, and some of them having to do with the way that the contracting between the governments and the sectors providing those technologies is structured. And that's by looking at this internal arrangements, which sometimes take the form of tenders, sometimes take the form of procurement specifications, that we can actually understand how the sectors get developed, right? And in a sense, a similar story has been told if you look, for example, at many of the accounts of how South Korea became so prominent, right? A lot of those accounts would, in fact, emphasize the fact that, you know, America granted it very special conditions of access to, you know, basically bidding on American defense contracts. So, and that mostly happened in the sphere of construction, not in the sphere of technology. So I think we can even broaden up this account to basically demand a more sophisticated historical account of just how actual geopolitically embedded capitalist competition happens, right? And once we start paying attention to the role of espionage, to the role of intelligence gathering in that story, very different factors would emerge, right? And to some extent, they have emerged even as we dealt with the revelations by Edward Snowden, right? That we have seen that there is a different story and a different set of concerns animating American diplomacy, but also animating the responses to the diplomacy locally. And it's not just driven by kind of capitalist considerations of cutting costs or making things more profitable. There is a different rationale, right, which our conventional economic theory and history do not often account for. And I agree by and large with the story, and I have advanced some of the elements of it myself, and I think we can kind of debate about the finer moments of it, but I think broadly kind of stated, this seems to be quite accurate, and that, you know, we definitely need new conceptual models for accounting for this kind of a very different type of competition. But then I think, you know, when you start using a concept like national security, it becomes a little bit harder for me to disentangle it from the kind of overall geopolitical orientation of a particular country. Because it's obvious that there is a certain national security agenda shaping the agendas of European states, but the overarching rationale that they all share, by and large, is still being oriented towards some kind of transatlantic tie with the United States. So the ability of even the European nation states or the European Union as a whole to kind of properly articulate what it would mean for them to be sovereign vis-a-vis, you know, the United States in the technological sphere, in a sense, is dependent on the fact that Europe still finds itself in the American orbit, and that whatever it would do to contest the technological power of, you know, Silicon Valley would come to haunt it through compromising its ability to receive military and other support from the United States, right? And it's that tension that I think is worth exploring, because if we properly account for it historically, not just in the last 10 or 15 years, but if you account for it from, you know, the 1960s, 1970s, then the answer to the question of why Europe doesn't really have technological giants that can compete with the United States, that question might receive a very different answer, because ultimately, perhaps, you know, the conclusion to draw is that the only region or country that can have such a technological giant equivalent or alternative to the American one should already have some kind of antagonistic relationship at the military and kind of strategic level with the United States, right? And this is how we kind of end up with China being the only other pole that has managed to put two and two together and actually put as much effort, money, and investment into building up this technological alternative, right? And this is why, even though, you know, I have often argued for the need for Europe to have technological sovereignty, and that, you know, is clearly a program that I endorse and I think we need to have it, but clearly that notion in itself needs to be problematized against this still rather uncertain dependence in the military sphere that Europe has on the United States. Right? And maybe I will stop here. Maybe you can react, or we can go into the more kind of finer kind of other things you said, which I don't disagree about, either the bureaucratic side or the need to invest in digital infrastructures, or I mean, all of that. I think it's completely reasonable. What I think we probably want to add at some point to this conversation is trying to articulate just from what normative stance, if you will, we can make this critique of digitization as it unfolds right now, you know, on the terms imposed by consultants, or on the terms imposed by Silicon Valley, or on the terms imposed by the Chinese big tech, right? Clearly, you know, it can be, there needs to be, at least that's my understanding, there needs to be a vision for what this alternative technological modernity, whether it's capitalist or non-capitalist, should look like, right? Whether it will result in greater autonomy of citizens, or the ability to organize better, or it will result in completely different relations within citizens and political parties. But there has to be some content in that alternative vision which will allow us to criticize and critique the current narrative of digitization, right? Because I think otherwise we end up kind of trying to basically make a critique of what's happening now, but using criteria that are not very political. So we might criticize Silicon Valley for, you know, being too arrogant, or, you know, I've criticized them for being solutionists, you know, many, many years ago, where the critique unfolds primarily on the intellectual plane and not on the political one. Or alternatively, we say that, well, they are not transforming us fast enough because they are these big monopolists, they're swallowing up everyone, and then they are not, we are not seeing as much innovation as we should see, right? And again, it's a plausible critique, but it doesn't seem to me a critique grounded in some kind of a political vision for an alternative political project, right? And it's kind of in trying to specify and articulate and make it more precise as to what the content of that political project should be that I see my own kind of philosophical and political project, right? It's trying to understand what can be that benchmark against which, this utopian hypothetical benchmark, right, against which we can, in fact, articulate a critique of digitization as imagined by SoftBank, or digitization as imagined by Alibaba, or digitization as imagined by the Pentagon, right? And I think we cannot do that just by holding on to some kind of neutral idea of modernization and then just saying that they're not really delivering it, or they're not delivering it the way we delivered the previous wave of modernization with previous set of technologies, like, I don't know, the television or the radio or the printing press. Anyhow, maybe this is too abstract for this particular segment of the debate, but I just thought I'll put it on the table.
So, to be more precise on this, yes, I do believe that civil military fusion, as we call it, I mean, it has the term has been used for China, but it could be used in the same way for the United States. I guess it maintains that in those production of contemporary modernity, we have an interplay which cannot be disentangled with the civil sector and the military sector in technology. And if we look, for instance, at what John Kenneth Galbraith wrote of the Pentagon in the 1950s or the 1960s, he wrote that openly. Those are not military private companies because they live off their procurement of the Pentagon, and they have a they could have a relationship of revolving doors coming to a segment and then to another segment, but there is no simple independence of those entities. So what was said in the 1950s and the 1960s for the build-up of the US military economic apparatus is now currently applied to the People's Liberation Army, with not much difference, I think. I do agree that we should start to disentangle this relationship from the military independence and the military awareness. It is not a case that those who questioned this after World War II in Europe were predominantly French. If we look, for instance, at works such as The American Challenge, Les Défis Américains by Selman Schreiber, and also how they were received in the United States. I mean, the only regional power who had who thought that had a shot at military independence was thinking about independence in technology. But this didn't happen. We know that. And also what France tried to do in terms of acquiring technological independence never became a full operational project. What has survived, I think, is the French approach to the relationship between competition, regulation, and markets. And what we are experiencing now with the debate you mentioned on the technological sovereignty still has to do, I think, with this, with the French idea that competition and regulation should not be in the way of Europe, but France, basically, through the means of Europe, advancing an interest in a region similar to those of China and the United States at the moment. So how I see this narrative is this building up at this moment in the relationship between industry, markets, and technology. So that's to clarify this. Mm-hmm. While with the transformative critique, I think you have a point on this, and what this is something that comes difficult for me, but I think also difficult for us Europeans. Why? It is because we kind of tend to dream of decades past. So we feel comfortable, and I think I am comfortable with the with the settlement of the mixed economy, basically, with the world of the Cold War. So what we try to do is always to get back to settlement between these military relationships, as well as the relationship between capital and labor that puts us back in a comfortable cradle of the mixed economy during the Cold War, because we felt we were in a better position as Western Europe, I'm speaking, of course, both geopolitically and socially, that we feel we are now. But at the same time, we feel we aren't able to pulled the strings to get us back to this position. And I think that's the part of this has been the endless debate in European states on technology, just on the fiscal side. Let's get more revenues from Alphabet or Amazon. It's part of this perception of our weakness and nostalgia at the same time. We just want them to be a little bit like auto industry companies that you mentioned before in the previous decades. So something that we is part of a social contract between capital, labor, and also our budget and the fiscal side, while at the same time we feel powerless in order to do it. And so what we do is that we ask for a higher power. Now let's have a world government in order to collect those taxes, and then we'll get back to the social contract of Western Europe during the Cold War. But at the same time, mm-hmm. other parts of the world, they do live in different time frames and in different zones. Of course, they do not care about our social contract during the Cold War in Western Europe. And so it becomes increasingly difficult to convince other parties of our idea, which is also increasingly difficult to realize, I guess.
On mm-hmm. this note, mm-hmm. Alessandro Negvieni, let me say goodbye to you. I'm really sorry to miss the rest of this conversation, but we will catch up another time. Thank you so much and enjoy the rest of
just
your...
Just a technical question to you. So are there questions that other people are going to ask us, or we just continue for another half hour?
No, there are questions.
There are questions. They should get asking
chat,
questions.
Yeah?
Because there's a chat. I read the chat, and then I can tell all the questions to you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. No. I have the chat open also, but I don't see any questions yet. Okay. So I think there are a couple of things that I can react to probably immediately. I mean, I understand what you've just said about this nostalgic longing for the kind of golden age of the European capitalism. I just, my critique of it maybe is somewhat different. I just don't think that, in a sense, provides a very valid ground on which to build some kind of an alternative imaginary, right? So, I mean, that's why it's so nostalgic, because ultimately we're just searching for ways in which we can innovate in order to restore the sense of greatness, as if, in a very bizarre way, Europe has already arrived at a perfect system in 1973 or something, right? And now we just need to understand how to reconcile that system with the year 2020. And I just think that in light of all of the problems on the horizon, from the climate catastrophe to, all of the problems piling up with the rising levels of inequality and whatnot, it's not really an attitude that can get Europe very far, right? That's why I don't expect the politicians and the political class to formulate necessarily this alternative vision. But I think we should not, giving up on a very important opportunity to reimagine what would it mean to do politics, what would it mean to kind of organize social coordination among different groups of society in a world where digital technologies today are available, at least hypothetically, to take on some of those functions. If you think about it through a long history, and you've mentioned bureaucracy, for example, to some extent, if you do an informational reading, if you will, of bureaucracy, and you travel back in time and you try to understand why certain structures of the state, particularly those that deal with law, have emerged the way they have, of course you would understand that to some extent, there was no other way available of reducing social complexity, right? So in a sense, the bureaucratic structures that did emerge and that then imposed all sorts of restrictions and constraints on how society itself could interact with itself and with other parts of the world, those restrictions to some extent were a function of our inability to design information and communication flows differently. And that, you know, if you were to start from scratch, and if you were to imagine how would you facilitate social coordination today, and what would be the goal of that social coordination? You know, what is it that we want to achieve? What is it we want to enable by letting people talk to each other, learn from each other, share skills with each other? What is the underlying rationale? Is it just to keep them satisfied, believing that they're part of an active civil society so they can then go back to the factory or to the office and be good capitalist subjects? Or do we actually want to imagine an alternative regime where, while pursuing all of this extracurricular, as we would call them, pursuits, they're also contributing to something bigger, and that something bigger might in fact be a new way to organize production, right? And those are the kind of questions that I think if we wouldn't ask them now, then Elon Musk would ask them, right? Or Jeff Bezos would ask them, and they would answer them on very particular terms that would favor Silicon Valley and their own companies, right? And it's in that sense that I think, you know, as much as I admired your book and the talk that you've given us, I think we need to be very careful in kind of universalizing the state-centric perspective on technological development and its alternatives. I mean, historically, of course, you are absolutely right that if you want to understand the trajectory of how technologies got to be the way they are, you have no choice but to analyze the role of the military and of capital and of the nation state all brought together. But I'm just not sure that, you know, we end up with some kind of defeatism where we really think that there is kind of no point in contesting that trinity, or we need to kind of understand what some kind of utopian imaginary might pop up on the horizon that will force us to understand that maybe there is a better way to rearrange society, and maybe that would fill in that project that you've described as nostalgic, which I agree it is. Maybe it would fill it in with a very different agenda and will somehow reorient the political parties, if you will, and the political forces towards this very different proactive rather than reactive agenda.
Yeah, I think that what we need to do, of course, when you try to build a narrative or an economic history, often one tends to focus more on describing what happens and maybe doesn't have in mind so much imaging those alternatives. So I think that should be another part of the job. But it's true, as you say, that you risk a kind of defeatism or a philosophy of history where there is no place for new action if you focus too much on those entanglements, thinking that they are invincible or they cannot be played with different roles and relationships. I think that we have less than 20 minutes, so I would like you to answer some of those questions. You have them?
I have the chat of the, but I don't see them. Yeah, so maybe if you can articulate what they are.
It's better if I read it to you. For instance, can apps like Immuni in Italy be a good starting point as a practical example to understand how politics approach to structure a platform on the health issues and therefore also for security in open dialogue with big internet-based companies? And And I'd also read by Chiara, what's the new social contract in contemporary capitalism? Is Europe out of the geopolitical game, in your view?
Mm-hmm. Okay, do you want to, should I tackle some of them? Well, I can tackle some of them at a somewhat abstract level. So, and that might not be a direct response to the Imuni question, but when you were talking about the experience of France, you know, I kept thinking back on the Minitel idea, which, I think time will come when we will reevaluate it with sober eyes. And, you know, for all of the defects that it had, I think we will have to take a stance that will be different from the one that is traditionally taken by kind of cheerleaders for internet culture, which is to denigrate it and to say that it's bad because it was a state-provided centralized solution of some kind to the kind of decentralized spirit of the early World Wide Web, you know, and we have all seen what happened to that early spirit of the World Wide Web. It became centralized among, you know, five American and four Chinese firms, right? So I think it's clearly important for us to experiment with alternative modes of infrastructure provision, right? And that infrastructure should be digital and non-digital, and there should be various actors involved in it. But I think just to crystallize what we've kind of almost arrived at in the last 20 minutes, there is this tendency, I think, which I hope your book will not reinforce, to kind of look at the recent history, and especially recent technological history, and try to seek lessons from it, but then to reduce those lessons to some kind of a formula and an algorithm. You know, this is what has worked. And if we only transpose what has worked in Silicon Valley to, you know, Puglia or Calabria, it will also work equally well there. You know, and this is the kind of logic that builds this accelerators and startup hubs everywhere, right? On the assumption that there was a certain context where things have worked and maybe it would work in a different context, right? And I think that what emerges clearly from your work, but also from some of the work I've been doing, is just how one-sided and decontextualized our account of many of these developments is. That, you know, we start with a very clear idea of what it is that we want to find in this historical experience, right? And then we go and we track it. If we want to arrive at a thesis that everything is moved by venture capital, then of course we'll find plenty of venture capital that was responsible for fueling Silicon Valley. If you want to start with an account that privileges the Pentagon, we will then find a lot of evidence that it was all about the Pentagon, right? So there is this almost functional indeterminacy in our accounts of technological development. And, you know, I think it's important to keep it that way. And that every time that somebody comes up with this semi-algorithmic plan for how we can create another Silicon Valley in some remote corner of the world, then we should really ask whether the other conditions actually are applicable or not, and whether for this particular context, a different model would be more appropriate. I'll just say two words on the social contract and sort of how Europe fits into it. It's a huge question, but I think we have to understand that, you know, for me, for my reading sort of what's happening with digitization now, it's that there is a certain also political deal, right, that exists between, on the one hand, technology companies and citizens, right? And there is some kind, I think, of a tacit contract that we are striking with them, in that, you know, on the one hand, the solving of really, really big problems that previously we used to solve through political means. You know, now, of course, with COVID, it's far more obvious, but you can also think about climate change. You can also think about even inequality. You can think about many problems. We have kind of delegated it to them. And through extension, we have delegated it to essentially global capitalism as such, right? So this is how problems that were previously subject to political debate are to be resolved these days. On the other hand, we all can innovate on the margins. So, you know, we all have ways to kind of refine and build and modify and remodify and to innovate the tiny little apps that these companies are building. And there are more and more ways for us to get engaged in kind of fixing what's broken in our communities by using, you know, all sorts of trivial platforms that are now springing up in order to facilitate this direct citizen action. So it's kind of almost the best of possible worlds where these massive giants are tackling the really important problems of humanity, but we, the citizens, can also transcend our alienation because we can tinker on the margins and also feel as if we are, you know, these bureaucrats finally empowered with saving the planet, right? And to some extent, this is what my paradigm of solutionism is supposed to capture, right? And I think it's very important to understand just why it's so hard for us to have a critical view of Silicon Valley, because their legitimacy derives also from this unresolved problems of capitalist modernity, if you will. It does not just derive from clever marketing and PR statements that they write or from celebration that they make in TED Talks. There is some kind of profound problem or profound, you know, niche or function in our incomplete modernity, if you will, that these companies are serving. And this is why we as users and as citizens feel so ambivalent about them and cannot actually formulate a properly critical attitude towards them. So as I promised, it's a very abstract level, to abstract answer to those two questions.
So I'll try, we are still receiving questions. I'll try to answer quickly one by Vittorio. In the 90s, we believed that the utopian internet would destroy nation states and build a free global society. Today's reality is more dystopian. States are disempowered. A few megacorps from a single country take over the world. So aren't nation states the least bad option we have in practice now? So I agree with part of the questions. The thing is that some nation states are not disempowered, in my view. I do not see the American Empire being particularly disempowered. I don't see Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party being particularly disempowered vis-a-vis Jack Ma a few weeks ago, but even in recent years. So somebody is not disempowered at the political level, as I see things. And of course, we have to consider how the what is we, starting from what Yevgeny was mentioning before. So how these social contracts in those powers are built, and what relevance do have some powers over the others. So I do not see the world becoming a place where just mega corporations are ruling all over technology. So states can be an option, I think, but it depends on how we relate with the internal power contracts among states, and I think we should have also some awareness of the past when we need to understand what went wrong before and what we can understand now. So other questions are asking how COVID is accelerating the tech war between the US and China. So in my view, this is a structural process that is being accelerated, but what we are experiencing now if we look at international relations relations by the US with its allies and China in technology, what is most important is acquiring other markets. markets for those technological giants by China, particularly. And how it has accelerated is that we are experiencing in East Asia and in Southeast Asia, and I think we will experience it a lot in the next years through the Biden administration, a lot of focus by the United States to try and block the actions of Chinese companies in those markets. For instance, India is particularly important for TikTok as well as Alibaba. But you know, this could get us to take too much time. So, other questions for Evgeny. The ongoing European cloud Gaia-X will be bound to the principle of GDPR as interpreted by the European courts. Is it not the first core of an alternative way to aggregate and manage data? And from Anna, people continue to see them, big tech, as harmless tools that solve complex problems and make our lives easier. How can we make the dangers of big tech's excessive power evident without being seen as Luddites?
Well, I think, you know, I've spent a lot of time thinking about the last question, how we can render their political power visible. And I think, you know, I keep sounding like a broken record, but I think here the only way to do that is to have some kind of an alternative vision, alternative modernity in mind. I mean, maybe it will be a very peculiar reading, you know, of Marx that I'm not going to make an offer. But, you know, if you look closely at Marx's analysis of capitalism, right, it kind of only makes sense once you grasp what the socialist system would do and would not do, right? And I'm not saying that there are direct equivalents with how we think about technology, but to me it's clear that the problems of the current technology we have and the problem of the kind of the way in which it builds and structures this current social and political system, they can only be evaluated and their full cost can be accounted for only if you manage to situate yourself in some kind of a radically different, you know, modernity, if you will, where the relations between citizens will not be mediated just by the market or by the state, where the relations between the citizens and the state will be mediated by something other than bureaucracy, where, you know, it would be possible to harness this immense productive power of humanity in a way that would not just be reducible to this label of work, you know? And I think in that sense, big tech, you know, we should not only see it as, you know, as an enemy. I mean, it is, but it also to some extent offers certain glimpses of what this alternative future might look like, you know, and I wouldn't necessarily, for example, disregard or discount the immense metaphorical and imaginary potential of an institution like the platform for imagining what an alternative social relation would be, because in a sense, you know, the platform, it's not fully a bureaucratic system, it's not fully a capitalist system, or at least it doesn't have to be that way, and it's not fully, you know, just a citizen, some kind of a civil society system, right? And if we actually try to be a little bit more imaginative, and we try to think about things which currently happen on those platforms. You know, yes, it's true that currently a lot of data is being taken from us, and that data is then converted into artificial intelligence, which then is used to make cars. I mean, this is terrifying because we are not being compensated for that data. I guess that's the most common argument. But if you think about it differently, isn't that kind of a promise of what a future society might look like, where we go about our everyday business, chatting to friends, chatting to each other, and somehow magically from there emerge this data, which is then used to automate the production of cars. I mean, if I were to build a utopian society, this is exactly how I would structure it, right? The point here is not that we should celebrate Elon Musk, we should celebrate Jeff Bezos, or we should just, you know, pledge allegiance to platform capitalism. The point here is that we have to be also on the lookout for these alternative models and models of social organization, and we have to see which parts of them we can actually make useful and institutionalize in an alternative paradigm. Because I think otherwise, we end up in either a very technophobic mode, or we end up essentially, you know, denouncing big tech as just being a complete reactionary force, which nothing to contribute to a critique of bureaucracy or critique of capitalism or critique of kind of existing civil society. And in fact, big tech does all of that, you know, and if you think about capitalism, that's what capitalism also did. You cannot just imagine it as a fully reactionary, regressive force. It contains progressive elements, and we have to understand what those elements are and try to turn them to a different system.
Yevgeny, I think that the clock has said that we have reached the end of the debate. Maybe we have 30 seconds. I mean, we tried to answer to most of the questions. Pietro Valfre wanted us to talk about Innis communication technology theory, but I think we need more time to do something like this. And we have other questions on the EU autonomy technological ecosystem, but I hope we will have the chance to chat again, and I thank all of our listeners for being with us. So thank you, Evgeny, for being at Biennale Tecnologia and staying with me and Juan Carlos, and have a wonderful rest of the program.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.